You're listening to episode 14 of season 13 of the GNU World Order for the 91st day of 2019. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu. Today we're going to talk about coffee, and we're going to talk about Flatpak, and a little bit about Snap, and a little bit about App Image. Now in the previous episode, we took a lot of listener feedback, and this is a little bit of a continuation of that, technically speaking. But the first thing I want to focus on, as I just said, is the coffee side of things. So I'm going to start, I think I'll start at the top this time, because this one is from Daniel. And he was the guy in the previous episode who was talking about Grav and Pico and flat file CMSs. And I had to truncate his email because then he switched gears and went into coffee talk. So I'll finish that email up just so that I can mark it done. Okay, so he says, Daniel says, about coffee, I cook it in a small pot, make water boil, take it away from the heat, add coffee, put it back until it starts to rise, then cover the pot and let the coffee settle for a few minutes. I'm not very hi-fi, but I like to use a good, tasty coffee that is not too dark, but not too light either. Lightly roasted coffee is the blight of Finland. And I like to add a mix of soy oat milk instead of cow. The earthy taste of the pot-made coffee goes better with that. I can identify with this, actually. I also like it, oat milk, if I can get it, I think it's quite good. I'm also kind of a fan of rice milk. Those are the two sort of non-dairy milks that I am most fond of, probably. I thought I'd really like almond milk, but it turns out to be a little bit grainy and not very flavorful, so I don't avoid it, but I don't seek it out either. So yeah, sometimes the non-dairy milks in coffee, it adds, yeah, quite a nice angle to the flavor of the coffee. But it's really neat to hear this, making coffee in a small pot. I kind of wonder what kind of coffee Daniel, I should have probably posed this question in the previous episode. I wonder what kind of coffee it is. Like, is it one of the thinly ground coffees, or is it more of a coarse grind, and then when he pours it into his cup, does he try to avoid getting the coffee grounds into the cup? Probably. I don't know. I want to know more, actually. But that's very cool. It's great to hear about. Well, it's great to hear about people making coffee. Not because I care whether people make coffee or not. I just think it's interesting. So this is Vulcan Writer. He says, I may have mentioned this to you. So this is the guy who was emailing about ZFS, and then about licensing and stuff like that. This time he's emailing about coffee. I've maybe mentioned this to you online, but I use a French press and have a bean grinder. Here are the ones I have. So to people who are not American, a French press is what everyone else sort of calls, or at least in New Zealand we call a plunger. Other people call a press. Other people call, there's another name that I'm just blanking on. But it's one of those a coffee pot that you pour the water in the ground, the coffee into, and then you press this little wire mesh down over it to keep the coffee ground stuff on the bottom of the pot while you pour out the liquid. So that's what Americans call it, a French press. For some reason, I'm not really sure why we call it a French press. I don't know if that's like literally just a marketing thing, like someone, whoever was first to market, decided, let's call this a French press. Because I swear at one point, a long time ago, I'm almost sure I heard it called an Australian press. But then sort of French press took over, or I'm imagining it. Or it really is very popular in France, I don't know. So he has links to this very specific things that he has. And I saw one of these before, and I forgot about it until this email. It is this handheld coffee grinder I actually don't know because it's just a picture, but I saw one, and it might not have been like the same, this might be different, but I saw one at my at a friend's house, and it was about the size of a torch, or rather a flashlight for Americans, or maybe one of those hand grinders, you know, where you grind like salt and stuff, although those come in a lot of different sizes, sort of flashlights, don't they? But you know, it was handheld grinder, and it was great because you could fresh grind beans just expecting to make one cup of coffee, and it didn't take up much room. That's the key right now for me, at least. So I'm really glad that he reminded me that those things existed. Anyway, he continues and says, "One of the things I find with drip coffee is that the paper filter absorbs the oils from the coffee, which gives drip coffee a two-dimensional flavor." That's a great way of putting it. I just think of it as tasting paper, but maybe what I'm also or alternatively tasting is, yeah, the lack of the actual part of the coffee that you want to taste. "An advantage of grinding your own beans," Volkermeier continues, "is that you can throw stuff in with the beans. Two of my favorites are break up a stick of cinnamon and pepper, like black pepper. Pepper gives it a unique depth of flavor. I have put pepper in a pot of coffee and people don't notice it per se, but they notice something. Strange as that may sound," this is class two again, "I've actually done that before. There was this holiday only coffee variety at Trader Joe's once." Trader Joe's is like a little grocery, well, not so little now, but it, yeah, so sort of, it's supposed to be the cool, hip, alternative grocery store in America. And so you go there and you can get things that you can't get elsewhere. And they're all packaged in such a way that make you think that, all of the, they try to, I think their thing is that they try to pretend like they're like an actual co-op or something like that. They have that vibe. And so you go in feeling really good about it. I don't know what their business is actually like, but I'm just saying that's what they say they're like. I don't know that that's, I have my doubts. But maybe not. Maybe I'm being cynical. So anyway, Trader Joe's, there was this winter coffee there, holiday winter coffee, and it had cinnamon and I think black and red pepper in it. And it was really, it was probably something else too, but I mean, it was, yeah, it was really unique in flavor. It might not even have cinnamon actually, but it was some, some savory spices put into the coffee, and it was really, really good. And you kind of got this sort of a flavored coffee, but without sort of like adding like sugary syrup that doesn't really taste all that good in retrospect to your coffee, So yeah, it was really interesting. And I can't find it here in New Zealand, of course. And so around the holidays, I'll sometimes make a cup of coffee with a little bit of cinnamon, a little bit of nutmeg, and a little bit of, yeah, just a touch of black pepper. Not much. Now, here's what happened this previous year or the year before, I think. I put way too much pepper in a cup of coffee once, and it was so horrible. And it was like at 4 in the morning, and I was drinking, that's when I get up in the morning. Yeah, I was drinking my first cup of coffee, and it just tasted like pepper. And it was just the worst experience, and I really kind of shied away from it ever since then, because it was a horrible, horrible experience. And of course, I forced myself to drink most of it until I finally realized that I was being stupid and poured it out. So do be careful if you try to add pepper to your coffee. You don't want to overdo this. All right. So here's a email from David, and he says, "The coffee talk was very interesting. I always assumed that using a paper filter was the most common way to make coffee." So did I, David, actually, for a very long time. Until I mean, New Zealand kind of enlightened me that actually that's not, I don't think that's common outside of America, possibly, or maybe just sort of outside of America and Canada. I'm not sure, but yeah, it's not, it isn't like the default. He says, "In the US, the," and I'm not going to say the name of this brand because I don't approve of the brand, and so I'm just going to pretend like I'm not even going to read the word. So in the US, the is really catching on for personal use. The basis of the is a single serving plastic container that has coffee and a filter built in. You place the single serving plastic container into a special machine that has a water. We all know what he's talking about, right? It's those coffee machines that you see around now, and you have to buy these special coffee pods, which are generally, yeah, made of plastic, as he says. And then you pop it in the machine, and the machine pours some hot water over it, or through it rather, pokes a hole in it and pours hot water through it. And you walk away with a single serving of coffee. And you, of course, take the plastic pot out and throw that away. Now, I don't have to tell you, dear listener, that if I were to ever subject myself to that kind of coffee, I would fill up a landfill. I mean, it would take no time at all. I have a lot of coffee throughout the day, as probably you do too. So that just doesn't work. And that's only one complaint. That's just the sort of the the ecological complaint, right? The other complaint is that they actually make really poor cups of coffee. Now, strangely, I did get one of these machines once, not for myself. I got given it by someone when I was, by a couple of people, when I was leaving a job. I was leaving the company to go to somewhere else. And I'm not big on social graces, but even I felt obligated to take their gift. Unfortunately, they didn't give me the receipt, so I couldn't get rid of it. So I had this thing. Luckily, they knew me well enough to provide this special reusable coffee pod. So it was like this plastic sort of filter. Well, it was a filter, yeah. And you could put it in place of the pod, and put your own coffee into it, and keep reusing it. So that was at least I wasn't. I mean, I wouldn't have bought the coffee pods. That's just not me. I wouldn't have done it. But I mean, I would have just used it for hot water, which is in fact what I eventually did. So I tried using it for a while, and then I realized that by using this coffee machine that just didn't make good coffee, in my mind I was kind of, saving money because I was making my own coffee at the office, and I wasn't going downstairs to the cafe and getting an expensive cup of coffee and so on. But in reality, what happens when you have bad coffee on hand and better coffee within walking distances, that you find yourself walking to get coffee a lot more. You know what I mean? Like, and you just at some point your brain starts to rebel against you, and it makes it so that you forget to make your own coffee. It makes it so that you happen to be out at a certain time so you can grab a quick cup of coffee as you walk, that sort of thing. So it was an exercise in trying to settle for bad coffee, and I just wasn't really going to let myself do that deep down. So the coffee machine turned into a hot water maker, which was nice because my friend, the last known god, had gotten me a bunch of really nice teas, and so I was able to drink like lots of tea because I had hot water. That it was an electric kettle, is what it was. It turned into an electric kettle. And the only thing that I really regret is that, well, number one, that I couldn't get rid of the thing because I didn't have the receipt. And then number two, I guess I could have tried to sell it or something. That's probably what I should have done. Although that's putting it back out there, right? I don't want that either. So the thing that I really regret is that it was on my shelf in my office for the longest time, so people probably thought that I actually approved of that machine. And it was like an advertisement. I mean, running Linux all day, right? People see that all the time. They don't take notice of that. They see that stupid coffee machine and they're like, I'm gonna go get one for myself because you condone it. You have one, so it must be okay. It's just unbelievable. All right, anyway, David continues. He says, we are also seeing a resurgence of specialty brew coffee from local roasters. The local roasters have traditional paper-based filter machines as well as specialized single-serve options like pour-overs from a company called Chemex, Chemex. At my home, I have a product called an AeroPress. It is similar to a French press in that you put grounds and water into a container, but there's a filter at the bottom, and you use a plunger to force air into the container and press the liquid through the filter directly into a cup. That's interesting. I don't know that I've seen that. The pour-overs and that sort of thing, I have had, like, just out, at random places that happen to do it. And I will admit that it does seem to make good coffee, but I don't honestly know if that's because they're being silly and fancy and pouring water over a weird beaker container, or whether it's just because it's really good coffee, and it would be good coffee whether they made it in a press or a pour over or whatever. If you want pictures, let me know. At my work, we wave both traditional drip. I don't know what that means. Traditional drip and a specialized machine that grounds the bean and combines it with hot water for a single serve through a filter, of course. Yeah, at my old job at the movie studio here in New Zealand, we had espresso machines in every kitchen, and it was a four-person espresso machine, so you could like four people could line up and make themselves espressos. It was amazing. And it was all fresh ground. You had the coffee grinder right there, and you would put your little espresso, container, the coffee part under there, and you would grind just enough that you needed, and you'd press it down with a press, and you'd put it into the machine, and you would make your own espresso or cappuccino or Americano or whatever you wanted to make. It was pretty great. Okay, and then finally he says, and he's sneaking in some tech stuff into his coffee email. He says, when you mentioned ARJ, two thoughts came to my head: Winamp and Commander Keen. For the record, dear listener, I have no idea what those are. Winamp, I'm assuming, is a music player, but Commander Keen, I have no idea what that means. That means that the early distribution of music files and shareware leveraged ARJ archives in the past. When I was in college, we used to frequent newsgroups looking for MP3 songs. We would find special download channels through private messages to download one song at a time. Shareware was typically distributed through BBSs, though. I'm not sure if that's where I used ARJ. There was also a large Where Is It Seen at the time that would drive you various. It would drive you to various seedy sites to get secret codes. It might ask you to go to some random adult website and look for the third word of the fifth paragraph. My guess is that it was a way to drive ad revenue. I used to leverage a text browser like Lynx to go to the sites rather than using Netscape Navigator, because the pictures were not work safe and the only place I had a decent connection, the T1, was at my job at the university. I also used you. So actually, let me stop there. That paragraph is such a 90s paragraph, isn't it? I mean, it's got all the 90s things in it. It's got the wares. It's got the MP3 downloads. It's got the apparently ARJ. It's brilliant. And using the internet at your work because you don't have a decent connection anywhere else. It is. That's yeah. That's a great snapshot. That's really. I know that anyone who was doing computering for reals back in the 90s can totally identify with that paragraph. Okay, so then he says, I also use UDisk CTL. Version 2 is used to separate mounts by user rather than a standard place like slash media. Yeah, and that is quite nice. If you use the mount functionality in Dolphin, it uses UDisk's version 2. That's very cool. I did not know that. I use Dolphin all the time, and I didn't. I never knew that that was what it was using in the back on the back end. Okay, and then I think, well, so I already read Brian in Ohio's coffee email. That was the coffee poem that his son did. But he also added that he just got his first programmable. He had just gotten his first programmable coffee maker when his son wrote that poem that I read on the last episode. And he must have hammed it up enough to inspire the words on the attached picture, which was, of course, the coffee bowl. So there you go. That's all the coffee emails, I think. Yeah. If you've got a coffee story or thoughts about coffee, I'm glad to hear more. That was a great collection, but there's always room for more coffee on GNU World Order. Hey, speaking of that. Got coffee now. You spent 20 minutes hearing about coffee, and now you have coffee. Or at least I do. Hopefully you do as well. Now I want to talk about Flatpak. Mostly Flatpak. I kind of want to briefly mention the other things that are out there, but I've talked about AppImage before. I did a sort of a tutorial on AppImage either on this show or HackerBolt Radio, I don't remember. Or maybe I just talked about it at a conference. Not sure. Really, and it doesn't matter because AppImage. In its current state, it used to be that AppImage was this essentially a wrapper around a .iso file, just the same kind of .iso file that you download when you're getting a Linux distribution. When you clicked on an AppImage or double-clicked or however you've got your desktop set up, as long as it's executable, it would mount itself onto the system as if though it was a thumb drive or something that you just plugged in, and then auto launch the application inside of that .iso file. Now you had given permission to it to do that, so it's no surprise. That's the design. I guess that was a little bit of a hack, though. It's certainly not the intent of a .iso file. And to get it to do that, I guess probably took a little bit of hacking, really. So what they've done for their second edition of AppImage version, I think of it as version 2.0. I don't know that they actually call it that. But whatever they're calling it now is that they're using SquashFS, which is a compressed read-only file system that you may have used before. You may not even know you've used before, but if you've ever used one of those live distros that that has modules like Slacks or Porteous, then a lot of those, sometimes those are in SquashFS because they'll be compressed and they'll be read-only. And so when they load the module, it'll overlay a file system on top of the base image, thereby providing you with new functionality. And that's kind of what App Image does now, is it puts everything into a SquashFS image, and then when you launch it expands that SquashFS image and runs it. And in theory, I think it's a much cleaner, kind of sensible way to go about implementing that technology. But the problem is that I can't seem to build a working app image anymore. It's just I've got a bug open about it. I'm just not able to do it. I know it's possible. I've witnessed it. App images out there exist that work. I'm just whatever it is about SquashFS and how it's mounting or how the paths get set, something about it I haven't quite figured out. And so hopefully I will eventually figure that out because I like App Image. I think it's a really great little project. But in the meantime, I've been looking at Flatpak, and I kind of started looking more seriously at Flatpak because of this email from Alexei, which is way too long to read, although to be honest, I could probably literally make an entire episode out of it because he really, really breaks down a lot of the different features of Flatpaks. And I think in a way, it's just a matter of really reading the documentation really, really thoroughly. And it turns out, for instance, that one of the killer features for me about App Image is that you could easily sneakernet an app image from one computer to another. And that's important to me because I know that a lot of people don't believe that anyone in the modern world would ever possibly be without a network connection. But I theorize that such an event could occur. In fact, I myself have experienced this. Either a network doesn't give you access to it so that you can act like a normal computer user, or the network just flat out doesn't exist. It goes down, or it's just not there. So it does happen, and even if it doesn't happen, I just always have felt like that should be a thing that Linux users can do. It's, hey, I've got GIMP on my computer, you don't have it on yours, here, let me hand that to you, because we're sitting right next to each other, so I'll throw it onto a thumb drive, I'll give it to you, and it will run. That's a basic thing, and to say that that's too much to ask is just silly to me. Turns out it's silly to the Flatpak people as well, apparently, because there's a flag, Alexei has told me. And again, I think he did this through the wonders of reading documentation, which I'll admit, I wish I'd done that. I mean, I've read the documentation. I guess I skipped over this particular thing because it is kind of buried in here. But it is flatpak-create-usb. It copies apps and or runtimes onto removable media. So that's quite exciting to me because that's exactly what I want to do. And it turns out that the way that works is that it creates a little Flatpak repository on a thumb drive, copies the stuff over, and then when you tell Flatpak to install, it uses that as the source if it cannot find a better source. That's hugely exciting to me. It was kind of permission to really investigate Flatpak in earnest. Now, the other thing that has swayed me towards Flatpak is the experience that I've had on Red Hat Enterprise Linux on my work computer. So I used to run Fedora on my work computer because I just felt like Fedora has all the applications, and RHEL kind of famously doesn't. And the reason I say kind of famously is because RHEL, Red Hat Enterprise Linux, RHEL is sort of an odd bird out there in the computer world right now in that it actually has support. And I didn't realize how odd that was until I was talking to someone and I was telling them that RHEL doesn't package a billion applications because they have support. And the person just didn't quite understand what I was saying. And so I realized the reason the person doesn't understand is because support doesn't mean anything anymore in the computer world. Yeah, back in the 80s and 90s, I guess, you could call up computer companies and and say, hey, I'm trying to install this this modem, and it won't work. What do I need to do? And they would tell you, oh, you just, you know what, you need to open up your computer, install it. You gotta go get the drivers, get the drivers from this location, install them. They would actually walk you through that sort of thing, I guess. This is what I've heard. I've never experienced it, but that's my understanding, is that that's where the idea of computer support actually came from. Now, in the modern world, that doesn't happen. You can't call Microsoft or Apple or Google and ask them for support, desktop support. You know, hey, guide me through this process. You can't even call, like, NVIDIA, which is just a graphics card, right? I mean, if you have a problem with that, you're not going to call them and get help on installing your hardware and how to configure the software. It's just not going to happen. So with Red Hat Enterprise Linux, because you're purchasing a support contract, that actually does happen. It can happen. I mean, you can buy a really cheap support contract where you just have online support, but you can get levels of support where you call Red Hat and ask them questions about things, and they will help you. A real life person who knows Linux will help you through the problem. And if that's the expectation that they're setting up, then they have to limit the scope of what they offer, such that the calls that they receive aren't going to be about, for instance, QTractor and Kdenlive Live and random things that they quite likely do not specialize in. And so their package selection is narrower. Now, there are ways around that. I mean, it's Linux, right? There's always a way around it. So if you pay for a Red Hat support contract, you download Red Hat Enterprise Linux, you install it on your computer, you can install, for instance, extra package. I think it's extra packages for Enterprise Linux, EPEL. You can install that. There's some other stuff in there. You could grab source RPMs from Fedora's repositories and then rebuild them on your Red Hat system and install them from there. Now, that's a little bit, that gets a little bit messy, because then, of course, if you're installing, I don't know, let's just say FFmpeg, then certainly FFmpeg has at least, I don't even know, let's say 20 dependencies. And it actually may not be that many, actually. But, you know, it's got like 10 dependencies, let's say. And so then you'd have to back up and get all of those RPMs, those source RPMs, and rebuild them for your Red Hat Enterprise Linux system and install those, and so on. So it can get complicated if you think, yeah, I'll just roll up my sleeves and make my own RPMs, because then you have to deal with a lot of RPMs and a lot of rebuilding. Now, you could script it, I guess, maybe, and I did think of doing that at one point. But this time around, I got a new laptop at work, and so I decided to just stick with Red Hat Enterprise Linux and try it out. So I'm running, believe it or not, GNOME, the GNOME desktop, and Red Hat Enterprise Linux on my work machine. And I have to say that I was really, really, really taken aback by the smooth integration of Flatpak. I had not realized that Flatpak had come so far so quickly. When you launch the software repository or the software installer application, which, you know, I generally never use, but I thought it's one of those things that I tend to check out whenever I'm trying a new distribution or a distribution that I've been away from for a very long time. So I launched it and looked at it, and I was seeing entries there saying that it was provided by Flatpak, or FlatHub, rather. And I thought, well, that's really crazy that they're just offering Flatpaks right here in their software installer. So to the everyday user, it doesn't look any different from just any old DNF install script. FlatHub's just right there. So you have things on RHEL like GIMP and Inkscape. And I mean, I think that's probably already there, but you've got like GIMP 2.10 instead of 2.8. And I'm pretty sure that's not normal. You've got Kdenlive. That's definitely not normal. There are all kinds of things that I've just never seen on a RHEL desktop before. I mean, not without a lot of work, and maybe even more exciting, it means that the versions of any given application that I really, really care about, the version that I'm running on my RHEL desktop is the same version to the very minor version to the edition that I'm running on my Slackware systems. And that's unheard of. That's just not normal. I mean, generally speaking, what happens is that I'm running one version of an application on Fedora, another version on Slackware, and then some other version on either the CentOS or the Debian or, you know, whatever other distribution gets involved because it was the thing that we purchased a support contract for, or it was the only thing that would install on this computer or whatever. So for it to be the same across the board is absolutely astonishing and really, really exciting to me. This is a big deal. So I want to step through, rather than just rave about this constantly. I could go on for another 20 minutes about it, but I won't. What I want to do instead is build a Flatpak. This isn't going to be fancy, because it's just a quick tutorial that's on Flatpak. So if you do this, you know, if you want to do this yourself, you could do this yourself. It is not something that I've invented or that I've spent a lot of time figuring out. This is just something that they've got right on their site. I will tell you though, and I'm going to do this on Slackware because I feel like that's the less native environment to do this in, right? I mean, if I was doing it on RHEL or Fedora or OpenSUSE or even Debian, GNOME, I feel like that's sort of expected. This is Slackware with not a GNOME library to be seen. That's not true, and running a KDE desktop. So this should be a pretty good test of the system. So the first thing that I have to do is install Flatpak and Flatpak Builder. And the way that I'm going to do that is I am going to leverage the power of slackbuilds.org. So I'm going to do my little interface to Slack Builds as sport. So sport search Flatpak, and I've got a desktop. In the desktop category, I've got Flatpak-Builder, which is Flatpak Builder Sandboxing Desktop Application Building Tool, and Flatpak. So there you go. So I'm going to do a sport install of Flatpak. Actually, I'm going to do a cat of Flatpak to make sure that there's not a lot of dependencies. Oh, there's a huge amount of dependencies. There's XDG Desktop Portal GDK, libsec comp, JSON glib, AppStream glib, OS tree, and bubble wrap. And all of those probably have lots of dependencies as well. So I'll install all of that stuff. And I know it's already actually installed, so I'm not going to, but I know from experience that the one that really sort of matters the most is OS tree. I mean, they all matter because it won't work without all of them. But in terms of updating Flatpak, OS tree and Flatpak are really, really tightly bound. So if you're ever doing Flatpak on Slackware or on something that maybe doesn't have it super, super well integrated, just know that OS tree and Flatpak are going to kind of go hand in hand when you're doing upgrades. So let's pretend like I've done all that stuff, and I would have had Flatpak 1.1.0 installed. And then I would want to install a Flatpak Builder. I'm going to do a cat of that to make sure that there's not a bunch of dependencies. The only dependency for Flatpak Builder is Flatpak. But there are a bunch of notes in here on the different things that I have to do in order to get Flatpak, or Flatpak Builder rather, working on my system. So for instance, there's a Flatpak remote add dash dash from GNOME, SDK GNOME. So we'll deal with that in a moment. And I know that that's there. So there are things that I might need to do in order to get Flatpak Builder building the right thing, and that's fine. But before I go through the install notes, because I mean it's already installed, so it's really just kind of extra configuration. So rather than reading through that and doing those steps yet, I'm going to go to docs.flatpak.org, which is obviously the documentation for Flatpak, the latest edition. So there's a section in there. There's a section on getting started and that sort of thing. The one that I care about right now is building your first Flatpak. And it assumes that you've got Flatpak and Flatpak Builder installed. We have that. It's telling us that in this tutorial, it's going to use an SDK. To understand the concept of an SDK, I mean, you may already understand the concept of an SDK. It's kind of a famous term, software development kit. But in order to understand how that applies to Flatpak, you have to be aware of the runtimes or the platforms of Flatpak. So there are, I guess, three different ones right now. There's the GNOME runtime, the KDE runtime, and the Free Desktop runtime. So if you've built an application, let's say, based on a bunch of KDE libraries, and you would probably know that you've done that because you'll have imported them into your code, or you'll have downloaded the cute libraries, and you would have used those. If you've done that, then you kind of know that you're going to probably need the KDE runtime. Now, as a normal user, you don't need to worry about that. That's not something that you would even ever think about. You would just go to the GIMP.org website. You would download, for instance, you would download GIMP, the Flatpak reference, and you would install it with whatever tool your distribution provides you for Flatpak interaction. If it provides you nothing, then you'll just do it from a terminal. And if you don't pay attention, you'll never know that you've just downloaded the Flatpak GNOME runtime whilst installing the GIMP application. Same goes for instance, Kdenlive and Live. You would never know that you just downloaded the KDE runtime along with the Kdenlive Flatpak. Now, if you've already installed Kdenlive and then you install Krita, for instance, you still have only downloaded the KDE runtime one time. That's runtime one time. And that's the advantage, I guess, of Flatpak, or that's an advantage of Flatpak over AppImage, because with AppImage can't really see outside of itself to a fault, apparently, right now, until I get it figured out. But anyway, Flatpak, you've got these base layers that you can install when you need them, and a lot of times you'll only need them once, even though you're installing, let's say, three or four applications, because those three or four applications are basing themselves on these sort of standard bases. But if you're building a Flatpak, then you do kind of need to know about what platform your application requires. And you can find that out more or less. You can investigate what's available in the docs.flatpak.org, the website there where the reference documentation, they tell you what available runtimes they have and more or less what each runtime contains. That's certainly all we need to know about that for now. So it's telling us pretty explicitly that we need to install the freedesktop.org runtime and SDK. And it gives us a command, which is flatpak install flathub, that's the repository we're installing from, flatpak, or rather freedesktop.org.freedesktop.platform//, that is two slashes, 1808, and then org.freedesktop.sdk//, again, two dashes, or slashes, 18.08. So that's two different things that we're installing from flathub. We're installing the free desktop platform and the free desktop SDK. So the equivalent of that in, I don't know, an app image or just designing an RPM or a deb file would be to go out and gather the libraries that you know that you need for your application to run. Whether you're packaging them in an app image or whether you're just referencing them in a spec file, installing a platform and the SDK are kind of, that's the 80% of that job done. So then you have to create your application. Ostensibly, you would already have that created, but for this demonstration, they have us, the readers of the tutorial, create. I'm going to go into my code directory here. I'm going to make a directory, and I'll call it hello-flatpak. And I'll go into that. Oops. Go into that. And they've got a really, really simple one here called hello.sh, I think. If not, I'll change it. But it's kind of predictable. It's /bin/sh, which is a symlink to whatever your shell is set to. And then the echo is hello world from a sandbox. That is exactly what I will do because that's pretty distinctive. Yep, and they call it hello.sh. So you've got your application called hello.sh, and I think maybe I will go a little bit further, and I'm going to create a directory called, make a directory called usr, and then another directory called bin inside of that. I'm going to move hello.sh into user bin, because I feel like in real life I would probably structure my code that way anyway. Okay, so now we need to add a manifest. Manifest file is a YAML, or a JSON file actually, a JSON file with information about the application. It's got a lot of stuff in it, and it needs to be called something like org.flatpak.hello, with a capital H is what they do, JSON. It's a unique string that's going to serve as the app ID for whatever you're working on. Now, since I am not with Flatpak, and I would probably in real life, I imagine I would be branding this myself. So I'm gonna instead do info.slackermedia, because I do own the slackermedia.info domain. Dot hello with a capital H, just because if that's the precedence they want to establish, then I'll go with that. Dot JSON. And then into that file, I'm going to paste the contents they provide. It's JSON, so it's just basically a dictionary list, if you think of it in Python terms. And the first element is app ID, and that is, of course, exactly what I just said, info.slackermedia.hello without the JSON at the end. And the hello is capitalized. The runtime that it requires is org.freedesktop.platform. You know that, we've installed it. Runtime version is 1808. The org.freedesktop.sdk, or rather, the SDK that it requires is org.freedesktop.sdk. And it's worth noting here that that final thing that's in all of these strings is init capped. So SDK, capital SDK, platform, capital P, lowercase platform, hello, capital H, lowercase everything else. So that's just kind of the convention I think that they're trying to set forth. So the command that we want to execute is hello.sh. We know that to be true. And then there's this thing called modules, and this is a sub, it opens up kind of a sub JSON list, a sub dictionary inside of or a sub list inside of the list, or a dictionary inside of the list. And then it's so this module, this first module, so square bracket, curly bracket, name is hello. Build system is simple. That I don't know a whole lot about yet. Build commands, and this is kind of this is the ad hoc install portion of the script. So build commands, and this I like over at least my current state of app image. This I prefer a lot to app image, because it's very clear to me as to what's going on here. So we've got install dash capital D, and if we look at the install man page, which I've done before, and I never remember what all the different forms of the dash D's stand for. The dash D is create all leading components of the destination, except the final one, which is, of course, the thing that you are copying. So we're doing an install dash D, and we're going to take user bin hello.sh, which is what I'm providing, right? That's the destination. And then we're going to put it in slash app slash bin slash hello.sh. That's kind of important because when we build our app image, that's where my files are going to get distributed to. And app bin, well, app slash bin, of course, is going to be sandboxed inside of this Flatpak called or info.slackermedia.hello. Okay, so we'll close that, and then we say sources. The sources are, the type is a file, and the path is hello.sh, except that it's in user slash bin. So we'll save that. Sorry, I did a few little variations there on their example, and we'll see how that goes. And that is technically an application. It's a simple application. Should I mod that hello.sh as executable? I don't remember it saying to do that. So I think we'll just leave it as is and see what happens. Okay, so the next thing to do, I mean, like I say, it's a simple application, but I think you get the point and the sort of the feel of it, which is we put stuff inside of a directory, and then we reference the stuff that we've put inside of the directory in a JSON file using a syntax that we would obviously gain from reading the documentation or looking at other Flatpaks. But we use a syntax to, within the JSON file, communicate to Flatpak where all that stuff that we've just put in there should go. Now we need to build the Flatpak. And this is kind of a two-step process. It's kind of interesting. There's the build process, and then there's the actual what you would have to do with the thing that you just built in order to distribute it to other people. So the first step that we take would be flatpak-builder. That's the command which we've installed at the beginning of this whole scenario, if you'll recall. And then we need to give it a directory. So I feel like the thing that would make most sense to me from previous experiences is to just make a build directory in my current directory. Just call it build, and then so flatpak-builder. So I'm just going to tell it the directory just build. So flatpak dash builder space the word build, because that's the directory that I just now created. And then I'm going to point it to my JSON file, which is in the current directory. So I'll just type in in and then tab over, and then sure enough, info.slackermedia.hello.json, and hit return. And it processes it. It's doing things. It's processing it. And it says install cannot stat user bin hello.sh. And that's okay. I know how to fix that. So if we open up the JSON file again, we'll see that in my install command, I had issued it the full path to the hello.sh. Remember, install -d hello.sh/app/bin/hello.sh. Well, I don't really need to do that because I've defined the location of hello.sh for the entire JSON file in my sources element in the JSON file. So sources, type file, path, user bin, hello.sh. So I'm going to just remove the user bin /sh from my install command, install -D. I'm just going to put hello.sh and /app/bin/hello.sh. We'll try that again. So I need to remove the build directory because it's got stuff in it, had the beginnings of a flatpak in it. Now make it again. So this is obviously perfect for a make file kind of process, but I'm doing it manually right now. And then we're doing flatpak space build, because that's what I just created, info.slackermedia.hello.json. And this time it runs through it and correctly finds everything. Running install hello.sh, committing build to cache, cleaning up, committing stage, cleanup to cache, finishing app. Okay, so cool. So that looks like it worked. So now we need to test the build. To test a build that you've just created, it's again another, it's a flatpak builder command, but this time it's got the --run argument. So flatpak dash builder --run build, that's the build directory, as you recall, and then the path to the JSON file, so info.slackermedia.hello.json. Kind of wonder why they think that's necessary. I guess maybe, I don't know, it's interesting. And then the name of the executable that we want to test, which is hello.sh. So I'll hit return, and it says hello world from a sandbox. So it's correct. My application is running. Now already this is a lot farther than I'd be able to get lately with app image, so this is very promising to me. And as you can see, it's a pretty well-structured process, I feel. This is stuff that I can kind of wrap my head around. The paths are complex, but not super complex. You know where to define those in a flatpak, and that's very comforting to me. That's kind of, I guess I'm probably dwelling on that right now, because that's the problem that I'm having with AppImage, is that I can't figure out where the root directory, or how to define that root directory is. But with flatpak, the YAML, the JSON file, I think JSON's technically YAML, right? So when I'm saying YAML, I'm not wrong, correct? I'm pretty sure. So anyway, that JSON file, the location of it, that's the root directory. So when you're telling the JSON file, when you're putting into the JSON file, okay, you know, the executable's here, the path to this file is there, it's all very easy to figure out. You know exactly where everything begins. So anyway, that's quite nice. So technically we've got a running application, but the thing about that is that you can't distribute it as is. You have to put your applications into a repository. Now a repository it sounds a lot fancier than it is. A repository is just a formalized sort of a package for a flatpak. And it's actually quite easy to make. So what we can do is we do flatpak dash builder again, but this time instead of --run, we're gonna do --repo equals, we'll just call it repo. And then we'll do a force dash clean, just to make sure that we're not bringing weird stuff from our cache into this scenario. We'll give it the build directory, which is build, and then we'll give it the JSON file, which is info.slackermedia, blah, blah, blah. So I'll just tab complete that. And that happens pretty quick, at least for me, because like I say, it's a tiny little application. Gives you some information about what it's doing and what it has done. And then you've got a repository. Now, if you put that repository somewhere on the internet, people could utilize it to install a flatpak. this Flatpak. We're not going to do that right now. We're going to instead add this little repository to our local Flatpak system, which is Flatpak dash dash user. So that gives us, we don't have to drop to root to do this. So we'll just do Flatpak dash dash user and then remote add, or remote dash add, dash dash no GPG verify, because we haven't verified this with a GPG quite yet. And then we'll have to find our repository, which is repo. Oh, well, we need to call it something first. Sorry. So we'll call it example. That's probably a bad name for it, but example-repo. And then it is, if you do an ls in the directory, you'll see that you've got in the in your main directory, in addition to the build directory, you've got this repo directory. So that's the repo. That's where that's located. So that added it. I mean, it didn't give me an error, so I guess it added it. And then Flatpak dash dash user again, because again, I don't want to become root to do this. Install, what did I call it? Example dash repo. And the name of the application that we're installing from this repository is info.sacramedia.hello with a capital H and no.json. We're not giving it the JSON file right now. We could be anywhere on our system right now doing this, this part here, the install, because we've added that repository to our Flatpak. If you are familiar with Git, this all seems very natural. This feels totally normal. Adding a remote repository, that's easy. And if you're not familiar with Git, then you can go listen to my Git series on Hacker Public Radio, and I talk a lot about this sort of stuff, including how remote repositories don't have to be remote. They can just be a repository, another directory on your computer. I've done that a couple of times. Well, heck, I'm doing it right now as we speak on a server, because I push stuff to the server and it copies stuff over to a directory where I want people to actually see the files. So, and the way that I do that is I simply add the destination directory as a quote-unquote remote repository. Doesn't really mean that it has to be remote. It's just, it isn't in that current directory. So that's what we've done, is we've said, okay, take this repo that we've just built, and by building it, all we've done is we've had Flatpak create this infrastructure for us, and it gets added to the Flatpak system. And now we're using Flatpak to look at our repositories, and it knows that there's one called example-repo, because that's the name we told it to name it, and we're saying from that repository look for an application called info.slackermedia.hello. It says installing in user info.slackermedia.hello/x86_64/master example-repo and then a commit number. Is this okay? Well, yes, it is. There it goes. Yeah, it was a quick install. Again, small little application. So now I'm going to just go out of the way. I'll go back to my home directory. So I'm out of my build environment, I'm back in my home directory, there's nothing, no strings attached. So if I do flatpak space run space info.slackermedia, remember this is the kind of syntax that I was kind of grumbling about the other day, still don't love it. Flatpak run info.slackermedia.hello, hit return, says hello world from a sandbox. And as you can tell from the sound of my voice, and you know that I'm an honest person, I am nowhere near that hello.sh script that was just invoked from Flatpak automatically because it is installed into my Flatpak subsystem, if you will. So a couple of notes on this. First of all, the first note is that actually when I installed it just now, it actually failed the first time, but I cut that out. And I cut that out because I didn't want to cause any more confusion on the process, because I'd already tricked you once with that path, the incorrect path thing. So the reason that it failed this the first time was that the export directory in my Flatpak, my local Flatpak folder, had been marked owned by root, which I don't know why that happened. The only thing that I have in there is I don't remember actually what it was, but I mean, it was just there was some thing that I'd installed, a Flatpak that I'd installed when I was playing around with stuff, and I installed it as root, but into my local directory or something. I'm not 100% sure. So I don't know what exactly happened there. And I probably I should have cleaned the environment before doing it. But I just want to kind of let you know, hey, there was a little hiccup there. It got solved. And I believe the problem was something that I'd previously done just messing around with Flatpak. I do not believe that it would have happened if that hadn't been the case, because I'm not Root right now, haven't been working as Root, so there's no reason for that to have been owned by Root. And I do not have any reason to believe that Flatpak itself or Flatpak Builder caused it to be owned by Root. I think that was just me being inattentive whilst doing tests in the past. Okay, so that's out of the way. The other thing is that the Flatpak run info.slackermedia.whatever thing, I believe that's what the Snap Daemon provides. I could be wrong, or I could be telling you an incomplete story here, but I'm pretty sure that the SnapD part of the Snapcraft system is the thing that brings to your system's attention that, hey, you need to add this to your path. This place is a valid place to run applications from. Whereas Flatpak does not have a daemon that you run, and therefore, and it doesn't add itself to any known path, so you have to either do that yourself or execute it in some wonky Flatpak space run space info.slackermedia.hello syntax that nobody would ever really want to use. So there's probably a correct way around that. I just don't know what that is right now. And who knows, it may even mean that in the future, I mean, if Snap has a daemon and AppImage now has an admittedly optional, but it is a daemon, they've got one, maybe Flatpak is going to have to head in that direction. I don't know. I could be wrong. Maybe I'm missing some details, but that's just something to take note of. The takeaway from this experience, though, is that Flatpak is very much an impressive system and something that I'm very excited about now, whereas I used to be a lot less excited about it in the past. But honestly, running a RHEL desktop and seeing what tight integration Flatpak can mean to a desktop and what it can mean across distributions, it's a really, really, really big deal that I don't think I really want to get away from. This is really, really nice. I feel like I'm living a privileged life now because I've just got all of these applications available to me no matter what distribution I throw onto a computer. Whether it's a computer that I dug out of the trash and had to install something super lightweight, but I still want to run, I don't know, PDFTK on it, but don't have that lying around. Well, I'll install it from Flatpak. Oops, actually I won't. Flatpak doesn't have a PDFTK, but Snap does. So I would install it with Snap. And I guess that's the quandary right now. We've got this great thing, we've got this Flatpak thing that's got a really nice system behind it. I really, really am liking it. And then we've got this other thing, which is Snap. And the Snapcraft crew have been really, really proactive in talking about Snap and demonstrating it. They do weekly, I think, video casts showing you more about Snap. I mean, it's very, very impressive. It's very cool. It just happens to be yet another canonical project that happens to be an alternative to something that's remarkably similar to it. And you have to wonder, obviously, given Canonical's history, their track record has not been necessarily stellar with their little alternatives. What was their display alternative called? Something like Mir or something? Of course, that's gone. Their alternative to GNOME, Unity, that's gone. Their alternative to Systemd, Upstart, I think it was called, that's gone. Their alternative to, I guess you could say it's an alternative to Dropbox, Ubuntu 1, I think it was called. That's gone. There are just so many things that you can look at and look back at all the wreckage. And so I'm looking at Snap, and it's given me PDFTK on a system that should not otherwise be running PDFTK. So it's huge. It's a big deal to me. That's something that I appreciate. And I've seen some of the video casts on how to build Snap, and it seems pretty reasonable to me. I'm just not clear on the advantage of having an alternative to something that is itself providing a unified system. So that makes me a little bit, well, I guess nervous, but also confused, because, I mean, really, which way should one go? I don't know. I can't say for sure which is the better model because I haven't really looked that well into Snap. That is a thing that is on my list, so I'm going to be taking a deeper look at Snap. Got to build a sample one, sort of start poking around inside of the Snapcraft resources. And ideally, if these projects continue going the way that they are going, with their central theme being unified, decentralized application distribution, then in theory, it shouldn't matter that Flatpak and Snap coexist. I think that there's still a little bit of a branding issue there, because if that mythical application developer, not so mythical actually, I'm like one of those mythical application developers at this point, some person with this thing that wants to look at Linux as a platform and say, hey, I want this thing to be available to everyone who uses Linux. What's the really easy way to make that happen? It's a kind of a tall order, and has been a tall order for a very long time. And that's why you go to websites and you click on the download for Linux, and it says, well, we're not actually going to have Linux, but if you look at your distribution, they should have it in their repository. Or maybe they do have packages, but then they have like 8 different packages, one for every popular distribution. That's the kind of thing that I think intimidates developers who aren't invested in the Linux ecosystem. They don't want to have to deal with that. They want fewer choices. They want one thing to target, to write into their build scripts, and then they're done. So if we have one thing to target, which might be Flatpak, might be Snap, might be AppImage, then that's what they can target. They can deliver to that one platform and know that they've just hit the entire Linux market. And I think that's important. It's not important to like Linux's survival or anything. It's just important for a better Linux experience. And that to, I think, anyone using Linux is significant. We want that. The fact that Flatpak has this create USB option is quite appealing to me, as you know. I've said that. So unless Snap has something very, very similar to that, I will definitely lean towards Flatpak definitively. Because at this point, like right now, Flatpak's the one that builds for me. It's the one providing me with most of my app, you know, most of the important sort of user-facing applications that you think about on your desktop. A lot of those are Flatpak right now on my RHEL desktop, a couple of them on my Slackware machine. So it's kind of got a lot going for it. AppImage won't even build for me right now, so I'm kind of confused about that. And then Snap, I have not looked into. That's where I stand, but Flatpak is really amazing. If you have not tried it yet, you should try it. You should build the demo app. I'll put a link to the little tutorial in the show notes. You should do that. It's easy. It's satisfying. It kind of gives you an idea of how it all works. So go do that. I'm going to go get a cup of coffee. I'll talk to you next time. Podcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @Klaatu @mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, GNUWorldOrder.info and SlackerMedia.info. I will see you next time.
with an adult in the car, like a chaperone. It didn't sound very exciting.